Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about death doulas and dying prepared. Our guest is Francesca Lynn Arnoldi, author of The Death Doula's Guide to Living Fully and Dying Prepared. Francesca is a community doula and death literacy advocate. She authored Cultivating the Doula Heart, and she's researcher with the Vermont Conversation Lab. Hi, Francesca. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to get started. There's two things I want to talk about in our conversation today. First, I want to get to know more about your work as a death doula, but also just death in general. So I'm going to be toggling between the two a little bit.
Sounds good.
So why don't we start with talking about what a death doula is and what services you provide?
Sure. A death doula or an end-of-life doula, they're used interchangeably. We are emotional support people who complement other layers of care that are normally already part of these processes for people. So when we think about doulas, we often think about birth and death. Also now it's expanding to include grief and potentially other trying times in life. So for people who are ready to plan and prepare and process, those are often the tasks that I keep in mind as a doula and invite people into that work. So it's very introspective, but then it's also thinking about practicalities and getting your voice and preferences down on paper, coming to clarity about who you are and what you're hoping for, what your worries might be as you journey through that. So within the field, we definitely have a role in scope, meaning that we wouldn't go into any other spheres like medical care or mental health support. Yet within the role, there is some flexibility for us as individual doulas to really think about, you know, what are my strengths and interests and my gifts that I really want to focus on. So some of us focus on things like legacy work, and that's something that I love to do. I love to listen to people's stories, and I love to sit back and invite them to reminisce about their life. And then sometimes we will turn that sort of informal processing into an actual gift that they can leave behind for other people. And so those could be audio recordings, or it could be written down. It could be individual letters for people. There's so many different ways that we can sort of capture a life, but that's something that a lot of people in the field enjoy offering to their clients. Also, I've done trainings about advanced care planning, so that's something that I offer to people. So getting their actual legal medical forms in order, or making sure that they know what options that they have for those forms. Sometimes that takes a number of visits because I'm not going to answer any medical questions, but I can help people come up with questions to ask their providers. So sometimes it takes a little while. It's a process to kind of look through where you're at in your medical care journey or not. I mean, some people do this well in advance and they might be in very good, stable health and they're just looking ahead. And then things can change. So you have to update those on occasion as well. So that's something that I support people with. There's a lot of connecting people to resources, which I feel like is an important part of my role. So when I'm training doulas, I always encourage them to look to their local community and to know what is actually already available so that we can bridge people to those important other supports beyond what we offer. So a lot of networking, a lot of collaborating so that we can make sure that people have all the information and all the options available so that they can make their best choice for themselves. So things like I've helped people research green burial options, somebody who was interested in exploring that in the area, you know, where is that available? What might that look like? What preparations do I have to make in advance to be able to access that choice? Some doulas offer respite care. So it could be providing a bedside presence, and that can relieve some of the other caregivers, the family members, the care partners, so that they can go take care of themselves, so that they can go for a walk or take a nap or go to their own appointments, which is really important because especially when people are on hospice care at home, wherever home is, it leaves a lot of hours in the day where their loved ones are taking care of them. And so they can get burnt out, and we don't want that to happen. So we can become that extra layer of support. Currently, I'm working with a new client who's interested in what's called VSED, so it's voluntary stopping of eating and drinking due to a long time medical condition that is entering into the later stages. So what I'm doing is I'm supporting the family through gathering information, making sure that they're really well informed before making a plan about that potential avenue for end of life. So there's a lot of variety within it and a lot of different ways that we can support people emotionally, informationally, even spiritually, so that they can have the most personalized, well-supported journey through the end of life and then into grief for the mourners left behind.
It all sounds really empowering, like what your work is doing is empowering people to just take control and understand what's happening to them and just, you know, just be fully prepared.
Absolutely. I think that with information and sharing stories, sharing resources, we lessen that anxiety that comes from the unknown. And then people can feel like, even though I'm facing the very hardest thing, even though a lot of the time people feel incapacitated and even rather helpless because of a terminal condition and they can't stop what's happening to them, they can find these places where they can assert their sense of agency and find that again and find their voice and have some say in what is happening so that they're not just a passive sort of victim of what's happening. They're involved, they're present, they're really still living their life as well as they can with the time that they do have.
Absolutely. And can you talk about your relationship with death and what drew you to this work?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways I haven't had death visit me too closely or too traumatically, which lends itself to me having enough capacity, at least in this current moment, to be able to offer my services to other people while recognizing that that could very well shift when my own needs might shift. But as a child, I really didn't experience that much death. I mean, we grew up on a road with all my family members, a family farm. So the life cycle was certainly very present in a very natural way. And I grew up having two great grandmothers that lived until I was about 10 or 11 years old. And so when they did die, it seemed like the natural order. It didn't seem devastating to my family, which was, you know, my lens into you look to your loved ones when you're young to see, you know, how should I be reacting to this as well? And so I didn't internalize those losses as being particularly traumatic. It felt like that was the way things go, and they had lived a long life. They were ready to die, and we gathered and we mourned, and there were, you know, rituals and things that we went through together. But I felt comforted through that, and it felt okay. I wasn't completely shocked by it. I wasn't completely alone in it. I felt involved as a family member. So that's how death was introduced to me. Now, the first time that it was introduced to me that it visited my life in a way that was extremely heartbreaking was when I was in my 20s, and a very close aunt of mine was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. Although we didn't totally know if it was terminal because her preference was to not really know the prognosis. She wanted to just sort of like live the life that she had left and not really hyper-focus on the time that she might have left and estimations of that. So that was her preference. And she was in her late 40s, which, you know, I'm in my 40s now. So it's sort of hitting me as, wow, she was so young. I mean, it felt like she still would have had so much life to live. And she lived so vibrantly in her short life. And so that was hard. She was like a second mom to me. I write about it in the new book. I share some stories and how much that impacted me, my frame of reference, my sort of natural ability to tune into what I needed and be guided by that through that time. And I spent time with her at chemo appointments, and I crocheted her hats for her head when she lost her hair, and we were very close. She would send me care packages. I'm looking at the little bear that she sent me right now. And it has this note that I rolled up and I tucked into its arms, and it's holding a bouquet of daisies, which have always been my favorite flowers. And when my cousins called to say that she was nearing the end, I very quickly told my coworkers I had to leave. They sent me off with hugs, and I came home to stop to grab a bag because I wasn't sure how long I might be gone. And I wrote a note to her, and I'm not sure why. I didn't question it. I just sat down, wrote a note, rolled it up, grabbed that bear, and went to the hospital. And I remember it felt rather awkward being in that room. She was within 24 hours of dying. I mean, we didn't know that at that time, but she was pretty close. She was groggy. She was kind of coming in and out of it. People were just kind of standing around. They wanted to be there, but nobody knew what to do with ourselves. We just didn't know what to say. We didn't know how to sort of like help. It was awkward. It felt so foreign and so unfamiliar to all of us. And later that night, the crowd had kind of cleared out because she was very loved. And I asked my uncle and my cousins if I could have a little bit of time with her. And again, like, I don't know where that came from. I don't know why I asked. I just listened to it. And so they said that, yes, I could have that time with her. So I crawled into her hospital bed very carefully, and I curled up next to her, and I unfurled the note, and I read it to her. And it was a pretty simple note of just expressing my gratitude and love, and, you know, everything that she had meant to me and everything she had done for me, and just how very much I loved her and still love her. And at that point, she was so weak that she couldn't even open her eyes anymore, but she whispered, "I love you," after I read the note to her. And so we got to share this really tender, really sacred moment together, which I think for me, she died just within a handful of hours after that. And for me, moving forward without her in my life meant integrating this unbelievable loss of somebody who, you know, just months prior was so vibrant, so bright, so full of life, laughing and skipping and teasing and all of that. Like, trying to wrap my head around that she could be gone was just unbelievable. But I found solace in knowing that I had shared everything that was in my heart, and there wasn't anything left unsaid. And that really did bring me comfort in the months and even years to come. So I think that while I didn't enter into the death care field at that point, it definitely was planting seeds back then.
I love how intuitively you knew what you needed. Like, I think that's a really powerful skill to have. Like, I won't go too deep into it, but I have a similar story about my mom. My mom was 49, melanoma. I was in the room with her while she was sort of in the active process of dying. And it, like you said, it's very, very jarring. Like, we didn't have a huge crowd or anything, but with her, instead of, you know, like your aunt knowing she wanted to just live her life without knowing the prognosis, my mom was very much in denial all the way until the end, which was really hard for all of us, right? Because we're just like, oh, she's going to get better. Like, she's going to be fine. Like, which means she made literally no plans, no wishes. Like, we had none of that, like, at the end. And so I appreciate, like, you knowing what you needed. And I think, like, in a way, maybe your aunt's response to her diagnosis also helped that a little bit, like her wanting to live that life and not have, you know, that hanging over her. Like, I don't know, there's something really powerful in that story that you shared.
I mean, I think at the same time, your way of describing your mom's preference is quite similar to my aunt's. You know, she didn't want to know prognosis. And I think a lot of that did come from a place of denial and just not wanting to believe that that was true. So I think while some of us could recognize what was happening and we could see the decline, and, you know, back then, especially pancreatic cancer, I mean, it was just untouchable by medicine. And so for her closest loved ones, especially, it was pretty shocking at the end. I mean, 2 days before she died, she was out having ice cream with a couple of her kids and just having a beautiful time and being her. And so, yeah, no judgment about what people decide for themselves. But in the end, if you have had important conversations, it can relieve stress off of the loved ones who then have to, no matter what, you don't have a choice anymore. Then you have to make those difficult decisions on behalf of someone. And that can lead to doubting yourself, you know, worrying if you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. It can lead to arguments within the family dynamic. You know, grief looks like all sorts of things. It comes out in all sorts of ways, and it can be very angry, you know, and if you're not aware of that, then it can kind of spin off in different ways, which doesn't generally facilitate healthy integration of the loss and a more healthy grieving journey afterward.
Yeah. And I think, you know, all of that experience has made me very much more open to talking about, you know, what people want when they're gone. Like, my dad is very clear all the time. Like, he's like, I want these things. Like, and so I think he saw how it impacted me and my sister and was like, I'm going to not go with that way. You know, I was wondering if you could talk about, in your book, you talk about mortality salience. I was wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah. Very interesting topic to recognize your own mortality and have that sense of salience. It's interesting to me because there's a bit of a dichotomy where if you look into some of the research, which I cite in the book, our brains actively try to avoid that reality. And we can kind of spin it into, oh, this is something that happens to other people, not me. Or this is something that will happen to me, but not for a really, really, really long time. So I think it most likely is a survival instinct. And so we can be gentle with ourselves about that. But even for people who acknowledge, you know, I am actually mortal, my time is temporary here in this world, in this lifetime, that it can feel still theoretical and largely abstract. And so, and like we're talking about with our personal examples, for some people, you know, they really might not ever reach that point of like, oh my gosh, I actually am dying. I actually am going to die. And that's not terribly uncommon for that to happen. Other people will reach that place of more acceptance, or they might have moments of it. I often see people kind of taking two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes one step forward, two steps back. And that's fine. That's, you know, psychologically very healthy to kind of lean into a situation and then start to feel overwhelmed by it and take a step back and take a breather. And we really do need to be respectful of our own pacing and not try to force ourselves into that, because that can lead to trauma and even more anxiety than we naturally might feel.
Yeah. And you mentioned that anxiety, you know, there is a lot of anxiety when it comes to talking about death, which sort of is, has like a taboo almost like in our culture, which is odd because it's something that does happen to all of us. Can you talk about how we might, you know, move through some of that anxiety and find a more balanced view of mortality?
I mean, I think having conversations earlier, you know, sooner in advance of crisis is very helpful. I think for me, I'm a proponent of gently introducing the topic of death to children. It's one of the reasons why I wrote my picture book, which is inspired by a conversation I had with my grandmother many, many decades ago, because we often resort to trying to protect children, trying to protect our loved ones against the reality of mortality. And in the end, it usually works against us. We usually end up feeling more shocked, more even victimized by it, and more traumatized by end-of-life experiences versus if we can develop that sense of healthy preparedness, which is what I advocate for. So I know for me as a doula, you know, I've worked in birth as a labor and birth doula and also as a postpartum doula, as well as the end of life. And when I explain what I do in my life, it's, I mean, almost all of the time, people I talk to, no matter who they are, no matter why we're talking, if it's a work thing, if it's just randomly out in the world, they generally have a story or two like sitting right beneath the surface that has just, it seems like it was just itching to come out. And so when I open that door and talk about my work, they often want to share their own story, which I think is incredibly important because we learn from each other all the time. And the more I learn from people and hear their stories, the more my mind and heart open and the better prepared I am to be able to support people through this. So I think talking about it, you know, sharing our stories, is hugely important. And providing people with an opportunity to share in a way where they're not going to feel like they're being interrupted. They can fully explore whatever they had gone through, whatever they had endured, or however impacted they were. They can fully explain that. And so part of what I do in my work is I'm a researcher with the Vermont Conversation Lab, which is out of the University of Vermont. And our project through the pandemic was story listening for grief. And so we invited people, everyday people, loved ones, friends, family members who had experienced a loss during the pandemic, and also clinicians and affected staff, to tell their story to a trained story listening doula interventionist. And it was fascinating. And I feel like for me, just increased the amount of compassion that I have, increased my awareness of what people were enduring across the nation and everything that they were juggling, all the emotions, the isolation, the loneliness, the complexities during the pandemic. And our goal was to really give them the time and space to fully tell their whole story. And in normal life, when we're having a conversation, often it's much more back and forth, and it's much more, you know, I can relate to you in this way, and I can share this about me. And it's, which, you know, is a way of talking back and forth. It's the way I talk to my friends. It's the way I chit chat and have small talk. But when I'm in my doula role, it's different. It's really about continuing to turn that spotlight back to the other person, to maybe invite them with a deepening question that's very invitational, and to allow them to just kind of go wherever they need to go. Because I can set aside my own inclination to try to make it better, knowing that that's actually not going to make it better for them, knowing that I can't rescue them from their journey, I can't fix what happened, I can't change what happened, and that my reframe is not going to be their reframe. You know, the way that they can come to clarity and understanding and healing is through really like going through the muck of it and unearthing everything that's in there and kind of going sideways for a while and then going backwards and then going forward. And that's the way they can kind of figure out who they are following something that was so profound that they went through.
Yeah. That listening is so powerful. And I hadn't thought about it that way until you just said it, where different conversations in your life, like, you know, maybe they're also impacted by the grief. So it's like, it's a back and forth of that versus you getting to fully just sit with it, talk about it. And I wanted to get your thoughts, because one thing that after my mom died, I would get mad when people said she passed away. Like, something about the softening of the language really like made me mad. And that stuck with me in all the years since then. And I don't know. I wondered if you had a thought on that.
I mean, I applaud that you recognize that about yourself and that you could see that pattern developing. I think that that makes so much sense. Like, death took your mom away, and that was harsh. And so to soften it doesn't feel like it actually is aligned with what happened to you. It makes so much sense. As a doula, I often try to take note of the language that my clients are using, so that I can adopt that same language as a way of showing my respect for them. And I will always leave the door open to, like, maybe they call cancer, you know, the big C, but they don't like to say cancer. I will respect that. I'm not going to forcefully try to get them to reach a different sort of place in their acceptance journey than they are. I am going to journey alongside them and trust them and their inherent wisdom about, you know, their pacing and their preferences and their choices. And that's a way of taking back some control over what's happening. And I totally get that. And it's really interesting how differently people even speak about death, dying, end of life, and the euphemisms and the way that we sort of explain things, whether it's from spirituality or religion or wherever it comes from. It's always fascinating for me to hear, you know, where people are at in terms of their mindset and their wording.
Yeah. And I want to ask about, I've seen a lot more coming up about this, but can you talk about the death positivity movement a little bit?
Sure. I think it's fabulous. I have so much gratitude for that effort. I think that it's really important, sort of like sex positivity, re-embracing these natural parts of life into our normal conversations, I think is so important so that it doesn't feel quite so mysterious. We're not keeping it in the shadows. We're really kind of bringing it into dinner conversations or into hopefully education and our awareness by sharing our stories back and forth. I tend to use death wellness myself instead of death positivity so much, only because I worry that people are going to misinterpret the positivity part and think that that means that you have to have only positive feelings about mortality, which is certainly not the case. And it's not what death positivity is all about. It's not what they advocate at all. But I worry that people might think, okay, well, if I'm going to try to reclaim my mortality, if I'm going to practice death positivity, then I have to be like happy about it. And that is definitely not true. I mean, there will be such an array of emotion. And so for me, I feel like death wellness does create a little, it feels a little more roomy to welcome in all those different emotions, like fear and anger even, or denial. And it's all just part of it. It's all really natural.
Yeah, just taking some of the taboo away is really powerful. Did you grow up with an emotionally immature, unavailable, or selfish parent? Join Lindsay C. Gibson, author of the self-help hit Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, for a 6-week intensive online course. You'll learn essential skills to reclaim your true self, build emotional resilience, and nurture healthy relationships. Sign up to learn more at newharbinger.com/gibson-gift and receive a free excerpt bundle from Gibson's books. New Harbinger Online Courses, expert help for better mental health. In your book, you write about the art of goodbye. I was wondering if you could talk about how you believe practicing this can benefit our lives and prepare us for major changes.
So in addition to talking more about the life cycle and pointing out examples from nature, especially that's very helpful, or what's happening in life and the people who have gone before us, I do think that practicing saying goodbye, practicing pausing and marking a moment, marking an ending, is a way that we can kind of build up that muscle and we can build up our coping techniques to be able to face more major losses in the future. So for me, I talk about one of our rituals that we do in our family, which just kind of organically evolved. I'm not even sure what the original inspiration was for it, but I call it our blessing stone ceremony. So when we're going to be ending something, something that has been meaningful, special in some way, whether that means it's heartbreakingly sad or it means we're overjoyed and very grateful, we can mark that ending by gathering up usually stones, but sometimes just little things from nature, and then having the opportunity to go around and share what it was about what happened that was meaningful to each of us, and maybe also share what we're grateful for. And then we sort of gift the rock as a way of releasing that. And that could be, you know, the example I use in the book is when our dog died and we were burying her on our property. And so we dropped our blessing stones in with her as we were burying her. Or another example I shared was when we were at my family's lake house for a week during the pandemic, and we just had the most beautiful time, but I could tell we were getting really cranky as it was coming to an end. And I hated the idea of leaving on that note after such an amazing time. It was super simple. Like, we barely did anything. We just sat around and swam 5 times a day and barbecued a little bit. Like, it was just beautiful. And so I decided at that moment, cued by those, you know, more kind of our grumpiness, that I wanted to lean into the goodbye and I wanted to acknowledge the goodbye. And so encourage the fam to gather up their things, and nobody has to say anything. Sometimes you can just take a quiet, silent moment and kind of keep it to yourself if you prefer. And then we all threw our blessing stones into the lake. That was our thank you and our goodbye. So we're able to hold it all, not just focus on, oh, this is ending, it's the worst, but like, what did we love so much about it that makes this ending hard, that makes us want to sort of cling and hang on? And what can we take forward with us in terms of our memories and the connection that we shared and the stories that we can continue to talk about going forward?
That's really beautiful and a total like flip on the goodbye. Like it makes it like infused with both good and the bad. And I think that's really, really cool that your family does that. And I wanted to ask more about ritual. I think that that is a common theme in the book. You know, you talked about your work. You love legacy projects with your clients. Can you talk about why ritual is powerful and maybe some other examples of rituals people might, you know, want to take up?
I think for me, coming from the birth field, I saw how powerful ritual was for laboring people. And when a laboring person feels safe enough and they feel like they have permission to just do what they need to do and kind of tap in and intuitively breathe their way through it and move in the ways that their body is telling them to move, then they end up often developing a ritual. And so as a doula, my role would be to kind of note what I was seeing and help them sort of develop that ritual into something that they could continue to repeat, because sometimes it was just happening and they weren't even noticing that it was happening, but I would be noticing that it was happening, and I would be noticing that it's actually it's helping them to cope with the intensity of what they're going through. So this could be a combination of, you know, support that they were receiving. It could be physical support, plus it could be the sentence that somebody was saying to them. It could be the breath work that they were doing, and it could be the movement. It could be the way that you're moving the shower head with the rhythm of their breathing and sounds. All of those things combined help somebody feel like they do have some agency, some sense of control over what's happening, because they can't control how quickly the contractions are coming, how intense they're going to be, but they can control how they can react to them. So that showed me without a doubt that ritual, there's something there. And I think for end of life, it can be really similar. So sometimes people want to have rituals as they're leading up to the death, and that could be gathering people. It could be something like a living memorial, having a party with their loved ones. It could be individually meeting with people that they share a strong connection with and having goodbyes in a particularly intentional way. It could be the services as well. It could be after the death, how the client wants to be honored, how they want to be memorialized, how they want people to gather. And so ritual, it gives people sort of a map. And that is really helpful when you're coming into a situation, you don't know what to expect, you just feel lost, you need a little bit of a map. And so sometimes these rituals can arise organically and you can just sort of welcome them in. But sometimes a little bit of planning and preparing can go a long way. I always encourage people to not be super rigid and to allow, you know, some margins there for the unexpected, because sometimes that can add a lot of beauty to what's happening as well. And if you have a person who is maybe leading the ritual, then that can be helpful as well. So you've got the map and then you've got sort of the tour guide, and it's very customized to each person, each experience, and what kind of goals they have in mind for it, and what kind of tone, what kind of vibe they're going for. And all of that put together, all the pieces, can really, similarly to leaning into a goodbye, you know, it's marking a moment, but it's also celebrating and it's honoring. And so it's not just thinking about what is being lost or what is ending.
Yeah. And I want to ask about memento mori. Over the pandemic, I got very in rabbit holes about Victorian mourning jewelry, and like, you know, they would wear it. Like, I think there's something interesting and powerful about like the mourning period that I don't think we really have much of these days. Like, you kind of get maybe like a week of people sending you flowers and checking in, and then it's just like you're expected to like go on about your life. But what I really like is those symbolic reminders of their loved ones. So I was wondering if you could say more about those symbolic reminders and like why they can be so powerful.
Yeah, for memento mori, I think it's more in advance of dying. It's sort of wrapping your head around that you are mortal at that salience. And that's a really important practice, just so that you wake up in your life and you're not just going through the motions. And sometimes we'll sort of lose sight of the big picture, and we're just just going to be going, you know, putting one foot in front of the other. And there's nothing wrong with that for temporary periods, but hopefully we will continue to sort of be reminded and wake back up so that we can live more fully and feel like at the end of our days, ideally, we don't have a lot of regrets about what we missed or what we didn't do, what we didn't accomplish, what we didn't say. We're actually doing that as we're going through our days and acknowledging that they're not going to go on forever and ever. So as we're talking, I'm looking at my bookshelf, which is a casket. It's a wooden casket, beautifully made. And it, you know, when it's called, right now it's just full of things that are very special to me and really important reminders. So it's like a big memento mori reminder of that I am mortal and all the little things that are within it, whether it's memories from working with clients or it's childhood books or it's homemade gifts that my loved ones have given me or doula students and clients. There, I mean, it's just full of things that I find very meaningful. And it's at the same time, it's like equally, yes, I am going to die. And yes, I am fully living right now, because right now I am alive. And so it's equal parts both. And having those gentle reminders throughout our days will keep us awake to living the life that we really will feel good about, hopefully in the end, when our time is coming to an end. And I think with mourning, it's so interesting to explore that. I agree with you. I feel like you can get sucked in and then you think, you know, how nice would it be to have something potentially that you could be wearing that would be recognizable to other people? And you're saying, you know, I am deep in some grief right now. So please, like a little grace my way will be very appreciated. And that communal disagreement about what that might mean and look like and expectations for people through that time, I think could be very healing and very healthy. And then I think about times when, you know, it's different for different genders. For women, historically, they were expected to go on for years sometimes in mourning clothes, and for the men, I don't know, it could be a couple of weeks, months, and then they're kind of good to go. So it is kind of interesting to think that it could be really liberating to be able to fully express your grief and be seen in that. And then in other ways, it could be really stifling. Like, I really want to wear color again. I really want to welcome, I don't know what it could be, more a new partner in my life or something. And I feel more ready for that, but you're not allowed to kind of do that because it's not socially sanctioned. So fascinating topic for sure. And I think that in some ways, people do this, but it's usually very unique, whether it's a family heirloom, like a piece of jewelry that they might be wearing, or something that they have in their vehicle, you know, that reminds them of a special loved one, or that they would consider to be kind of a guardian angel, maybe to them, who has died. So many different ways that people interpret that, depending on their framework in life and the connection that they shared, but it's not as recognized because it's totally individualized.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And I think, like you said, we all maybe do it in our own little ways that wouldn't be recognizable. But yeah, I was like, I want to know everything about this, like deep rabbit hole, super fascinating. And it's interesting to see how, you know, these conversations about mourning and death do shift from generation to generation.
Very much so. I just wrote a blog post about memorializing, as we just, you know, we have Memorial Day in the month of May, and this time of year, it's also equally about life reemerging from the earth. And so my gardens are starting to bloom, and some of my first flowers that I see are my irises. And I call my gardens collector's gardens, because I tend to just collect different divided perennials from different people, neighbors, family members, friends. And so it's like my gardens tell a story of kinship and of legacy. And so these irises come from my mom and her gardens, and those irises in her gardens came from my dad's mom and my dad's grandmother as well. So it's many generations. And then also my husband's aunt, my aunt-in-law, when she was leaving her long-time home, she gave me some irises, which were her grandmother's irises. And so even that is a memento mori reminder to me, and a reminder of the life cycle and rebirth and reemergence and generations. And I love that. I love seeing those reminders around me.
Wow, that's so cool. What a cool garden, and what a cool like lineage to have just like out in your yard. Like, that's so beautiful.
Absolutely.
I want to ask, one concept that I found really intriguing was death decluttering. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the benefits might be?
Yeah, I think it's another practice, sort of like the art of goodbye. It's another practice of memento mori in action, and acknowledging your mortality and acknowledging impermanence in general, and acknowledging seasonality. So when you're able to kind of go through your things, your belongings, and separate yourself from them, realize that you are not your things, and also hold gently, yes, and my things do reflect parts of my identity and different eras of my life. And then you can mindfully sort of sort through them and begin to question, you know, do I really need to hang on to all of this? Can I release some? Can I let some go? And it's a beautiful gift to the people who will be cleaning out your things, you know, after you do die, versus kind of holding on to everything and then somebody's got to do that work for you. So regularly assessing, how much do I need physically, and, you know, what is it adding to my life? What, when I look at it, when I see it, you know, when I hold it, what is it adding to my life? If it's not meaningful, practical, beautiful, or really connected to special memories, then maybe it can be a time to let it go. And then that can lead to feeling more, it's another way of exerting control over things too. Like, you can have more control over your space. It's more intentional, it's more mindful. And when you are able to clear things out, it usually feels like your mind is able to find more order and more peace generally for people after that, after organizing.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice for the, you know, I've cleaned many a loved one's home after they've died, and it's a nice idea that what's left are things that were important to your loved one, versus like you might just be throwing everything away and not realize that you're throwing away something that was really sacred for your loved one. Like, my husband hasn't experienced a lot of death in his family, luckily for him. And so whenever we go to his grandparents' house, he still has his grandparents. He'll say he likes something, and his grandpa will be like, "Do you want that when I die?" And he'll be like, "Oh, like, why you talk like that?" And then when we leave, I'm like, "No, that's like him processing like what he's going to leave for you." Like, I think there's like power in that. But if you're not like thinking of it in that way, it comes off as really like morbid, right? But it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, definitely I've known people and worked with some people who would put a little bit of masking tape and or sticky notes, and they invite their loved ones to come through and really identify, what do I have that is meaningful for you? Because we can't assume that what's meaningful to me is going to continue to be meaningful and welcomed into somebody else's space. But if we can have those conversations in advance, then, I mean, those things, those reminders can really facilitate that continued bond, that continued connection that often we do seek in our time of mourning.
Yeah. And Francesca, as we start to wrap up, I wonder what you might say to someone who's just beginning to, you know, lean more into this death wellness or resiliency, and they're ready to dive into something like your workbook. Maybe, you know, they're not facing an illness, but just like interested in this work.
Yeah, I definitely encourage people to tap into their own rhythm and their own pacing, and really try not to force yourself. You're probably going to come up against resistance, and that's to be expected, and you're going to have to work through some of that resistance, but be really compassionate with yourself. Think about talking to yourself as you would a beloved, as you would your, you know, your most favorite pet or person or family member or best friend, and use that gentle inner voice to kind of work through some of that resistance, but also don't be super forceful about it. And know that you're going to have times where you need to take that step back, and then other times where you want to take a couple steps forward. But it's very, I mean, across the board, when people do find the courage to lean into this and do some of this work, some of this preparation, you know, this book was inspired by my own death journal, which is, it's basically a scrapbook that I've been creating for my loved ones for many years. It's a compilation of letters to them individually and kind of as a whole. It's poetry, song lyrics. I have lists in there that I included in the new book. So happiness is, comfort is, a gratitude list, lists about beliefs. So it's an exploration of who I am and how I hope to be known by people. It's my voice on a page. It's my essence. It's my wishes for them, my hopes for them taking good care of themselves moving forward when I cannot. It's my preferences for care and so much more that I have included in this. And I find that some people will ask me, you know, isn't that depressing? Isn't that, doesn't that make you sad? And yeah, sometimes I do have a heavy heart when I think about my loved ones needing to access this because they know about it, they know what it's for, they know where to find it. But my feelings of relief outweigh that substantially, knowing that during that time when they're in the depths of heartache and heartbreak and they're missing me and they wish that they could still, you know, sense me around them, that they're going to have this. They're going to be able to hear my voice and have my messages. I'm going to continue to be able to comfort them even in my absence. And that actually provides, it feels like it lifts the burden. And across the board, this is what I hear from people when they find the courage to do this work and to lean into it, that they feel lighter, that they feel freed up then to go and live their life fully because they've sort of checked off this stuff off their list. And they feel a sense of accomplishment and more contentment and peace.
Yeah, I could see how it would leave you feeling that way. And that's really powerful too. Like, I would give anything to have a death journal from someone like my mom. So I think that's really impactful for me to think about for what I want to leave behind as well. So I think that's really cool. This feels like a good place to wrap up unless you have any final thoughts you want to leave with the listeners.
I feel like we've covered so much. It's been a very meaningful conversation, and I just wish everyone the best wherever they are in their journey and to take good care of themselves.
Well, thanks so much, Francesca, for your time and for your work. I think this is such important work, and a lot of people are going to get so much value from your work and your book.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
If you're preparing for the end of life or simply looking to bring more meaning to the here and now, The Death Doula's Guide to Living Fully and Dying Prepared imparts valuable insight to nurture clarity and internal strength on your journey. Infused with essential doula approaches, this workbook is a first-of-its-kind publication that invites you to process your life and legacy, create remembrance projects, build connections to vital supports, and draft informative wishes and plans for your last chapter. Replete with centering techniques and thought-provoking prompts, this comprehensive workbook is a welcome invitation for anyone seeking a more intentional approach to living and dying. It provides a practical template for end-of-life planning focused on designing comforting experiences that feel personally affirming, with sensitivity to all belief systems, cultures, identities, and histories of lived experience. The practices within chapters promote death literacy and present steps to create your custom death journal. Completing this workbook is a brave act of healthy preparedness as it breaks down a complex and often overwhelming topic into manageable tasks. You'll tap into deep truths and poignant memories as you work through exercises, often feeling lighter and less burdened upon their completion. Most importantly, you'll find your best way to live fully and die prepared by clarifying the fundamental ideals, priorities, and requests you want honored. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives.
Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzle, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.